Good morning to everybody. We'll start in just about a minute. Continue with Kohelis today. Hope everybody's doing well. Continuing from chapter 2, verse 12, in Kohelis. That's King Solomon's book, Ecclesiastes. Now we just do a brief audio check before we start. So once you hear the audio, just type audio OK at the bottom of your screen. That confirms for us that you're picking up the audio stream properly. Okay, Joel, thank you. Thanks for the confirmation. Good morning, Cal. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Good.
Josh is here with us.
Hey, Josh. How are you today?
Hey, good morning. And someone else on the phone?
It's Rivka.
I thought she was on a minute ago. Maybe they're on mute or something. Wait for a second.
Yeah, Rivka and Rivka here too. Good morning, Rabbi.
Okay.
Good morning. Okay, any questions before we get started? We're going to continue with Kohelis. But maybe it's good if you have any.
Right, okay.
Any questions come up during the week? Anybody needs?
I'm okay for now.
Okay. Okay. So what we had discussed last was King Solomon's experimentation with different activities. And that included building houses and vineyards and orchards and brooks to water forests, acquisition of servants and silver and gold and elaborate wagons, all the main areas that a person assumes that he derives happiness from. So he used this himself as an experiment to see if this actually afforded him anything. And he concluded that his chachma stood with him, meaning he saw through it. And that's an important lesson because most people will delude themselves, and they keep on assuming that the next possession or the next trip is something which will afford them greater enjoyment than the last time that they were frustrated and it didn't meet their expectations. So instead of accepting reality, they assume the next time it's going to be a little bit better. But he doesn't do that. He is brutally honest. That's the whole purpose of this work, is to really get at the root and to uncover what everybody else is really feeling. Well, why is it that these things aren't satisfying? And when you think that it will be satisfying, isn't that really just an assumption? And did it really take place in reality or not? it really is an amazing work, for, you know, in that respect, that all these different assumptions, all these delusions are completely unveiled as being a fallacy, just a charade, the game that a person plays with themselves. A lot of it comes from the fact that people feel that if many others are doing something, there has to be some semblance of truth to it. And he uncovered the underlying emotions too in the whole process. For example, surpassing anybody else. He says that he, in 2:9, he says that became great and increased more than all those before me in Jerusalem. So there he's telling you, not just a fact, but that he's uncovering another emotion that perhaps is operating in a person. And that is, well, if I could beat out everybody, if I could be, it doesn't matter that I've got $1 billion if the guy next to me has got $2 billion. So there's this inability to be satisfied with what a person's needs when they're being covered and then some. Because the person's got a competitive emotion that is eating away at him and really does not do anything for him anyway. So here he says that. Now, somebody's got their mute button off? Okay, so he uncovers that by saying those few words that I increased more than all those before me. And there you have to explore, what does he mean by that? It means to say that there's an underlying feeling that that would have been something that affords some happiness. Then you have to explore that further. Well, why would that be? What is the assumption? So that's what we're discussing here. We're saying open that the assumption is that if I am better than others, if I win, so then that means I will be happier. So that's an assumption. It's not something which has ever been analyzed. And people do that. They just operate based on assumptions. So he wants to help out humanity by exposing all these assumptions. And of course, there's so many, you can't do it in one book. But the core issues he touches on. Again, he touches on, in 2:10, how he did not hold back anything from his eyes, from his heart. Why does he tell us that? He tells us that because there is another assumption that a person feels that if he had unlimited wealth, if he had unlimited access to everything, that would really be happiness. And he tells you that the only happiness he ever had was when he was actually in the process of doing something. It wasn't the actual obtaining. It wasn't the actual, actually not obtaining, it wasn't the actual possessing of something. That didn't do anything for him. Because he talks about that in 2:11 when he reflects now after he obtained everything. And he said it was a vexation of spirit. Right, he says, Ruach Ruach, and then 2:11. When I look back, and now after he completes the work, now reflecting on what he has, that feeling is not something which really affords happiness. It was an assumption, and that's what 99% of the world follows, is this idea that if I have more, I will be happier. So he experimented. He showed you this is not true. But he did say there was happiness in the process. That's what if a person has an endeavor that they enjoy, and perhaps that's what it means in Pirkei Avos when it says that you should love your work. I mean, there is a certain amount of, there is a need in man, we talked about this, ambition to accomplish. That's a need because without those feelings, a person would not be motivated to secure his necessary needs for living and eating and family and then basic happiness. So God built a person with that motivation, with that libido, that energy, and it goes and it's motivated towards certain, a person projects onto reality, this is where I'm going to be. So there is a good over here that a person has that image in his mind of where he wants to be tomorrow, the next day. So that motivates him, and the prospect of success is necessary to move man. But it has to be done intelligently. Go ahead.
Is that a fantasy, though? Because it seems like that we get caught up in, well, I'll be happy when I get the new job, I get the new house, I get the promotion, I get the car, I get to go on the trip or whatever. And so we're always pushing happiness out into the future. And then when we get there, at least I think oftentimes, it doesn't measure up to what the expectation was. And the success people will, you know, say what you got to do is set goals, and then when you meet those goals, you set some more goals, and you meet those, and you set some more goals, which seems like this never-ending cycle. Is there supposed to be, I think from a Taurus standpoint, a true satisfaction in that idea of achievement, or is that just a fantasy?
Achievement alone is not the goal. That's the point over here. That the what we're going to encounter now in 2:12 is where King Solomon says that now I'm going to analyze attitudes, lifestyles, a lifestyle of wisdom, a lifestyle of acquisition and accomplishment, and a lifestyle of just drinking. Meaning, on the one hand, I'll analyze with a life of wisdom. On the other hand, we'll look at the lifestyle of work versus play. So there'll be three attitudes he's now going to go into. Now, the successful business people that you're quoting that realize that when they arrive at accomplishments, it's short-lived, and therefore they say, well, then you have to do it again, and that's a constant cycle. They are omitting the one vital component that really gives man satisfaction, and that's his intelligence. That's the core of a human being. That being ignored, that pursuit of wisdom that we see displayed in the Einsteins and the Newtons, you know, par excellence, where they were completely absorbed, that is something which the businessman has completely omitted from his agenda. That's why he assumes, well, it's because I have to have a constant cycle of setting new goals, and that will give certain satisfaction. But that's not true. He will never be satisfied. There may be momentary satisfaction, but if the satisfaction, if the accomplishment is not teamed together with the whole human design, so then what is he satisfying? What does the accomplishment really do? It's completely ignoring the element in man that needs to be filling itself with ideas and wisdom and seeing the bigger picture and understanding his purpose as a human being and answering his philosophical questions. That whole philosophical side of man is ignored in the agenda of your common businessman who's taught and teaches others that happiness is purely financial considerations and position and fame. So that is not true, what they say. And the but there is value in the very faculties that God created in us. He gave us a need for accomplishment. He gave us feelings of satisfaction. And he gave us the ability to project onto the future, which is a certain amount of fantasy. But all these things are necessary, and they will contribute to a very happy life if used properly. The question is, what's the dosage that the person is taking of each? And is a person ignoring certain dosages on the philosophical side? See, that's what they're doing. They're overdosing on one part of the human psyche and completely ignoring another part. So that's why they have to come up with a solution. Oh, it's because you have to set new goals. But you can ask them a question. Well, if the last goal didn't do anything, why should I fool myself and say if I repeat this behavior, it's going to do something more the next time? See, that's the fantasy. That's what King Solomon is exposing. That's what he says when he says that there was a certain happiness in the work that I did. He says, "What ki libi semech mikolam alai." My heart was happy in all the pursuit, in the work, in the process. There we had happiness. But then when I have it, and I now possess everything, and I now have bought all those toys, and I have all the money for everything, that did not lead to anything. That did not afford happiness. Just looking at things that I own, that is not a happy thing. And one important reason is because there's another emotion called novelty. Novelty wears off. And that's for good reason. That's part of the design that man should be frustrated with the physical hopefully to redirect his energies towards the world of wisdom. That's also why you have the concept of things rusting and getting older, the physical thorns and thistles. That's what God had given to Adam as a corrective measure, that if he tries to put his energies into the physical world, he's going to plant fruits and he'll get thorns. Meaning to say, that's a paradigm, that's a parable for all pursuits that are purely physical. The physical world is designed to be frustrating at a certain point. If you use it properly, if you eat the right amount, you occasionally have things that are tasty, and you can't just live on chocolate, but it's good now and then. You can't eat meat for every single meal. You can't even enjoy it after a while if you have the same flavor over and over again. All these different designs, and you build structures, and they eventually corrode, and they rust, and they warp. And this is all to show you that do not put your energies in the physical in and of itself. These are merely just areas that reflect God's wisdom. You should use it for your own needs, but redirect yourself towards the world of wisdom. There you will find, as King Solomon says in 13, that I see that there is benefit to wisdom over a life of just accomplishment, as there's benefit to light over darkness. And again, we'll have to understand, what does he mean by that? A lot of the statements sound very simple. But again, this is a man, you have to appreciate that he was given wisdom miraculously overnight at 12 years old, when he became king because his father, King David, died. So if he was given such amazing wisdom, we can't just read his book like some great writer of the 19th century. Okay, long answer, Doug, but did it address your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Now, and again, looking at possessions that you have, if you think about it, well, how can that give you happiness? Where does happiness come from? Happiness means, we have to define happiness. Happiness means where an individual being is in line with its nature, that there's no conflicts, there's no hunger, there's no pain, temperature is proper, health is intact, there's nothing that's ailing a being, all the necessary feelings are being satisfied, there's no rejection by peers, there's a sense of social acceptance psychologically. The person feels what he does is correct and in line with what the Creator wants. He's in line with reality. He understands there is a Creator and there is a term to his existence on Earth. He seeks to satisfy answers to questions, which naturally will arise. If he's honest with himself, he eliminates or addresses denials that he has, such as a person's feeling of immortality. Person who's truthful with himself faces that. He embraces it. He does not run away and afraid to get an answer. He wants to get an answer. He's in line with truth. So we move forward now, and we tread on some new ground. And he says that in 2:12, he says, "Now I turn to look at three things: at wisdom, at just drinking and folly." And that's sichlus, which Ibn Ezra describes as building and acquisition. So the accomplishment, the pursuit of accomplishment, making a great empire, building up a business. So now he's looking at these three in terms of value systems and actual activities. Meaning he described different objects and pursuits which cater to base emotions. We talked about that being money and the social era, where he acquired many servants and beautiful wagons, which would be equivalent to like a fancy car, and gorgeous homes, ego. So all the main areas he talked about, but now he's talking more of a categorical approach. Now that did not prove anything, let's look at the rules of the book, which attitudes really exist. Well, you have, on the one hand, you have a life of wisdom. On the other hand, what else can a person do? He can be involved in work and play. So if we take those, that's how I'd boil down these three. Wisdom, work, and play. So he says in 12, he goes on, and he says, now the last thing he mentions is the acquisition of building. But then he says a statement. He says, Ki meha adam, what is man that he comes after the king, after all has been made? Okay. Well, what is he criticizing here? Okay, one sec. Ibn Ezra says, what ability is there in man that he comes after the king? Because why? Because all that which has been made, all that which can be made, has already been made by others. Of course, including God too. What is he bothered by here? When he talks about the life of, now he's taking one of the three, he's taking the life of building, acquisition, and his first critique is, what is man that he comes after the king? And he's already, after all has been made. And again, his verse is beautifully crafted to give us the answers to.
Is he saying that if you've got a king who's managed to do all this great accomplishment, and then you come along and do some more accomplishment, like, well, what have you really done? Because somebody else already did this stuff before you anyway.
Okay.
And then a king has all the resources available to him to do all of this. So he's already proved that the life of wisdom is the better life.
Well, what is the specific rejection here? And it could be, I'm not sure yet, it could be the king is talking about God as well, not just the human king.
What is the man who will come?
You got to think into it a little bit here. It's what is his rejection?
So in the Hebrew, the second clause. I mean, mine reads for what is the man who will come after the king concerning that which they have already done? Is it they plural? And it would seem that must mean all the people who came before.
Let's see.
They is clearly plural. If you're missing it.
Yeah, Uncleus, who I learned recently, they say that a parable. Of course, he lived in the Roman era, much after Sinai. But the rabbis say that Uncleus was also given at Sinai with the oral law and the written law. I mean, it's a praise to him that his interpretation is just beautiful, as if it's right in tune with the oral and verbal law. I mean, the oral and the written law. And he says on this, what benefit is there in man that he prays after the king has already decreed upon him a punishment? Because it's already been decreed upon him. So it sounds like he's referring to God. And he's talking about a different area too. Let's see, who else has comment on this?
Rashi seems to take it as punishments as well.
Right. Really, it's better off that man should ponder his actions first before he did his actions, and he wouldn't need to request mercy from God. Exactly. So how would we fit that into his initial statement that, that I turn to view wisdom and a life of just foolishness, you know, just drinking and just pleasure, and also a life of acquisition and accomplishment? For what is man that he comes after the king? So is he saying that there's going to be punishment? All right. I think there's another idea here. Psychologically, that it also says man ha'adam, meaning what is, look at adam, a different way you could speak about a person. So adam really refers to the fact of adama, from the fact man was created from the adama, from the earth. Adama means earth, right? That's why man is called adam, Adam, from the adama, from the earth. So he's a creation. So King Solomon first hints to the fact that man is a creation as well. And he comes after the king. Perhaps this is telling you that in terms of what man is looking for, King Solomon says, what really is man? So why does he say what really is man? Evidently man is looking for something in terms of himself. What is really man? Meaning, when a person when he says this, it's as if a person already said something, and then you responded to him. Well, what really are you anyway? So, what was the real conversation? There was something which took place first. There's an unspoken assumption over here that King Solomon then says the words, "Well, what is man anyway that he comes after the king?" So, what is he addressing? What assumption is he addressing? He's addressing that man is looking for some sense of accomplishment here. We talked about that, being sichlus. He's looking for an accomplishment, a self-image, a self-worth. But he's doing it in a form which is merely just manipulation of what already exists. I mean, if we take the king to mean God, so that means God created everything already. What possibly could man do that is going to give him a sense of accomplishment? Anything he's going to do has to pale by comparison, because he could only manipulate what already exists in terms of the limitation of laws and the limitation of what exists physically. I mean, there's two things that God created. There's the substances and the laws that govern them. And based on the limitations of both, that's how far man can manipulate these things. But that's all he can do. So perhaps he's talking about, in terms of the sense of accomplishment, if a man wants to fool himself and think about the great empires that he builds and businesses and so on and so forth and the fame, he can fool himself if he likes. But if he's a person that's a clear thinker, like King Solomon, he looks past that and he said, well, what really is that? I can't do anything compared to what God did. And I'm also limited. I'm just moving around the objects that he made, and I'm working within the confines of the laws that he structured. So how far can I really be satisfied with my minuscule manipulation of things? It's like putting a baby in a crib and giving him a few red blocks. So he's limited to his movement. He's limited to what he can create, how high it can be, because only a certain number of blocks. He's limited that the fact they're only red, there aren't colors to them. So based on all that limitation, what type of success can he have? Kavar Asur, the last words of the pasuk, it's already been created. Or he has already been created. Can you get some feedback there?
Yeah, we wondered if you were getting it too.
Does everybody have their mute on?
I don't.
Hello? A lot of interference?
That's better.
Yeah, now it's better.
Okay.
Hopefully.
Everybody has a cell phone sitting next to their telephone that can also sometimes create interference.
Alrighty. So what I'm just trying to expose here is definitely an underlying motivation, which, if it's used properly, it's then it is a good, meaning to have a sense of accomplishment and to have goals and to move forward. That is a good. But if a person is looking for his happiness in that alone, then that will be a problem. And Chaim is writing on screen, he says, did King Solomon recommend not to try to accomplish because of the emotional impact or frustrations? Did he say don't try? No, no, just the opposite. King Solomon is saying that a person shouldn't look for happiness purely in this one area. And that was Doug's question earlier, that if the common businessman whose happiness he looks for solely in his constant climbing of the corporate ladder, if that's all he's doing to look for happiness, then he will be frustrated because he's ignoring the essential part of man, which is his intelligence, his the pursuit of wisdom. So a person definitely has to use accomplishment. He has to follow that. But it has to be an intelligent approach. Food is necessary too, but if you do it in the wrong proportions, it can be lethal. So right now, he's discussing one element. In terms of a lifestyle, the attitudes that people have, the person just solely absorbs himself in this sense for accomplishment, this need of accomplishment. So there's going to be problems. Okay, now what this tells you even further is that when he says, what is man that he comes after the king? I mean, what is he really going to do? So that shows you that there's, what is the prime emotion that's motivating him?
That he's somehow going to be greater than the king?
Okay, but there's emotion there. What's the core emotion?
Ego.
Right. And Mitzudas David says it is God. He says, as follows, what can man be considered that he despises with his syphilis and his heart, that he should become wiser after the king of the world, after all has been made? So he's saying exactly as we said, that after all has been made by God. But he says further, he says, interesting twist, he says, Uvara es ha-sichlus. And God even created the sichlus. Meaning, if a person wants to claim a certain award, let's say he's winning the Emmy Award, the Academy Award, whichever one it is, for the best comedy ever. And he now gets up and he gets the award in his hand, and he says in his arrogance that I am the best comedian ever, because that's what he really wanted to be. He didn't want to be just second best, he wanted to be best. But if the person who invented comedy, let's say comedy was an invention of another person that preceded this guy, now could he walk over to the inventor of comedy and said that I now am the best comedian? The answer is no, because the originator, the original, nothing can be better. There's no such thing as being better than the original. You could do something different, but if Henry Ford made the first Ford, nobody else can come along and make a better Ford. They can make a better car. Or Rembrandt is a better example. Rembrandt makes paintings. Now other people try to copy him. Can you ever make a copy that's better than the original? That's impossible. Copy, by definition, means duplication. Not alteration, not any improvement. You can't improve. If your whole objective is to be the best counterfeiter, so you don't want there to be any change in the dollar bills that you make, you want it to be identical to the original dollar. To make any change the color. Hey, I think red would look better. You now miss the mark in terms of what copying means. So also, if a person is on Earth and he is now trying to accomplish, but can he do anything in terms of accomplishment? God is the one that created accomplishment. That's what Exodus Davis said. It's a very subtle point, but it's a beautiful point. He's saying, how can a person seek to be the best accomplisher if the very phenomena of quote-unquote accomplishing is something that God created? You can't be a better accomplisher than God. He is the one that created the whole nature of how accomplishment works. Setting up objectives, following a certain rational path, addressing the potholes in the road, and finally achieving and maintaining the accomplishment as planned. Well, that is something which God designed. You can't do better than that. You can't come up with a better way to accomplish. You hear the point?
Yes.
That's excellent. Yes.
It's a very subtle point, but Mitsuda's David really hit the nail on the head. I mean, a person is trying to have a certain sense of, hey, I did this. But you have to, if that's tempered with the reality that I did it as well as humanly can be done, fine. But if a person is trying to be the best, so then he's going to be entirely frustrated because you're limited by the way God designed how anything you can do in life will be done. There's only so far you can go in terms of making a structure. There's limitations. How narrow the structure has to be a certain height, and how much wider it must be, and so on and so forth. So if a person is working within that, then he'll be happy. And I believe that's really the next verse, where he says in 13, he says the following. He says, and I looked, and I saw that there is a benefit to wisdom more than ambition and building, just as there is a benefit to light over darkness. Meaning, Re'isi Me is now I'm reflecting on what I just said in the previous verse. And now I looked. I mean, it doesn't have to be, but it seems to me that it's a continuation here. And he says that, now why is wisdom better? All right, so we'll get to that in a second, but let's make sure we have it clear what is saying up to this point. Again, Yud Beis is telling you, verse 12 is telling you that there is ego. That's why it says, for what is man that he comes after the king? Meaning to say that man is looking for that self-image of the self. He's looking for that that reflection of the self that he takes pride in. That's really the objective. He wants to have that fame. He's climbing the corporate ladder. And not just for all that money, he has the competitive edge. He has the need to be on top. So if he just incubates his fantasy into a closed sphere that he's only dealing with other people, so then there's a certain gratification. But if a person realizes that there's the king, there's God that created this all, and really, what are you anyway? Like King David says, and that's what Ibn Ezra quotes here. He says, what is man that you should be mindful of him? And what is the son of man? And again, he uses the term Adam, or Ven Adam. And what is the son of man? Ketif Kedena, why does King David say, why does he have to say, what is the son of man? I mean, what David is accurately describing man's humble place in the universe, he says, What is man in general that God should be mindful of us? We're nothing in the whole scheme of things. And even more, he points to the fact that we are created. I'm really, even within the realm of man, I am dependent on a father. If I don't have that, I don't even exist. So he's shown you the feeble nature and the dependent nature of man to counter the very emotion of the man is always trying to inflate his ego, and he's trying to have that type of feeling of ego and satisfaction. That is the wrong path in life, and that's going to be constantly met with frustration because there's always going to be somebody who's better at something than you are, who's healthier, who's more successful, whatever it is. If that's where your energies are going, so then a person is constantly going to be meeting with frustration. It won't be happy. So that's why he says, the next verse, he says, let me see, Chaim has a question. First you asked, are we supposed to live with frustrations? No, we're supposed to understand how we should stop doing the actions that lead to frustration. So we're not supposed to try to live with frustration. We should understand it. What gives us frustration and abandon that path? Okay. Then you wrote, if God put the design of the new thing into man's head and he doesn't accomplish the reward of this new thing, can he blame God? No. And also, a person doesn't know if God is putting an idea in his head or not. We don't know that. We only know that God does something if there's an outright miracle. But if we get an idea, that could be our own creativity. It could be God's giving us knowledge. But we have to. Every idea that we have in our head doesn't mean that God put it there. There could be an idea that we think about right now is really not even a good idea at all. We just think it's good because again, the ego is looking to pat ourselves on the back at every turn. So we have to constantly be on guard for that. So man's success and his failures, he can't blame God. He doesn't know when God is working or not. So you can definitely can't blame God. All right, so let's see. Okay, so we're just about to say, so what is he bringing in verse 13 now? And he says that I looked and I saw that there's a benefit to wisdom more than accomplishment, as there's a benefit to light over darkness. Okay, so think about that for a minute, and then we'll take this verse now. Any questions at this point? Let me just pause and see if there's any questions or comments.
Rabbi?
Mm-hmm.
Rabbi? May I say something?
Go ahead, yes.
Yeah, it just seemed that the ego has such a strong hold on the person, and the person, whoever it may be, has to have a better control of the ego. But then on the other hand, we have to realize also, that we have to accept the different things that are not good so that we can make a comparison to what is good. Maybe this is what he's saying, is we can see that we have to see the difference between light. We don't really know how beautiful light and how wonderful light can be. And what it can do for us, unless we have experienced the darkness. And therefore, it also, it says in reference to the wisdom, we have to understand that the wisdom is the light.
But how is it better, though? He said, what he said over here, again, we have to read the verse and try to observe what he's saying here. He says, I saw that there is benefit to wisdom over accomplishment, as there is a benefit to light over darkness. I mean, what's the parable, and what exactly is the benefit? I mean, we said that accomplishment is needed. We don't deny reality. God made accomplishment. It's a necessary thing. But where is the benefit of wisdom over accomplishment, and that why is it akin, why is it parallel, light and darkness?
Rabbi?
Yes?
It strikes me that the common thing is that light brings clarity, and so does wisdom.
Okay, good.
So if you're stumbling around in a room, it's much more advantageous to be able to have the light on and be able to see so you don't walk into stuff than it is to walk around in the dark. So the person that's just accomplishing but doesn't really see the big picture that isn't really what life is about will just be like the person stumbling around in the dark, whereas the person who has wisdom can see how the world works and how man fits into it and won't make the same mistakes as the person who can't see that.
Okay, good. So the... if you had to describe what the benefit is and what the ridicule, what the benefit of wisdom and what the ridicule of accomplishment, so what would you say the ridicule is of accomplishment?
That it's pointless in the end. Well, that's not true, because some accomplishment isn't pointless. But it's pointless as seeing it as the source of one's ultimate satisfaction.
Okay, good. See, I would say further that darkness means he's completely wrong about something. And what I believe he's saying over here is that the difference between wisdom and tzichlus is a fundamental. I mean, because when you're involved in building an accomplishment for the sake of promoting the self, what you're doing is an act of you're being proactive. You are projecting a certain notion and following that as being a truth, when in fact it's a lie. Your assumption that rising up and climbing that corporate ladder, and this is a good in and of itself, is a complete lie, because there is nothing that it gives you in and of itself. Because what you're trying to say is, I'm better than the king. You look at the King Solomon's words. He's trying to show you what the underlying emotion is of a person who is just following that lifestyle. You're trying to climb up, you're trying to have a certain sense of accomplishment, but you can't be best. He's saying the ego is always looking for you to be number one. Not just better than half the people, but better than everyone. But the problem is that you are a creation, and you can never outdo God. So how good can your accomplishment be? So he's trying to show you, and he's exposing to you that most fundamental critique of that sense of accomplishment. If you're pursuing it as an end itself, of course, accomplishment, I'll say it again, it's a necessity. That's why God created it. So that's why he's saying wisdom is just the opposite. Wisdom is not where I'm projecting onto reality an opinion that I am the best and that's really where I get the satisfaction from. It's just the opposite. Wisdom is a passive pursuit where you are a receptacle. You're not projecting, but you're receiving. You are open to observing and understanding. The self is completely not in the picture anymore. Just the opposite of where accomplishment is the self. You're trying to put billboards all over every great city on earth with your picture and the number one next to it. Wisdom is a pursuit where it's just the opposite. You are a receptacle. You are looking out at the world and observing and recording new phenomena and understanding patterns and seeing how the intricacies are and how they work and the beautiful design behind it and appreciating the creator that's behind all this. So he's pitting up two complete opposites. One who is foolish. He is just looking at accomplishment as a ends in itself, and in such a case, he can't possibly satisfy what the ego is really looking for. Again, the emotions have a tendency to go to the extremes. That's why Maimonides says that the best life for a person is where he's not too miserly and he's not overly giving. He's in between. He's not too irascible, and he's not completely a meek, shy person, but he's in between. He speaks up when necessary, and he's quiet when necessary. Why does he say that that's the best life? So Rabbi Chait explained that when the person is at any extreme of the spectrum of a given emotion, right, whether the emotion is in terms of the attachment to money, so in terms of, again, the attachment to money, it could be no attachment at all, person looks like a fool and he's poor, or a person is money hungry and that's all he ever wants. So in both cases, if you're at the extreme, that's where the greatest magnetism exists and the emotion has the strongest pull on you. Sexually also, say a person is never involved with any sexual drives at all, or a person is constantly involved. Either way, there's a very strong emotion pulling towards either one. A self-image of being an ascetic, of being a monk, and that's a good thing. Or a person is just kind of like a playboy, and he's constantly satisfying the desire, and the desire just builds up more and more. The rabbis say that if you satisfy a desire, it gets hungrier. So when you're at either extreme of an emotional spectrum, of any emotional spectrum, there's the greatest pull that the emotion has on you. And the problem with that is that the mind is not free to really be involved in wisdom if their emotional pulls on him. When's the best state for the mind? When the emotions have the least pull. And that's when you're right in between the two poles. Everybody see that point?
Yep.
Imagine two magnets on a table. The table is 2 feet wide. You put a magnet on the edge on the left and another magnet on the edge on the right. If you put a ball right in the middle of the table, it will not move because the magnetism is neutralized from both ends. If you move the ball towards one of the magnets, it'll start having a greater pull towards there, and then it gets stuck to the magnet, and it's harder to pull it off the magnet. But if you put the ball right in the middle, it's free of the pull, and now you can be evolved in wisdom to the best degree without any intrusion from the emotions. So that's necessary. But again, what he sees over here, what King Solomon sees over here, is that when you're living the life of wisdom, then you're living as a receptacle. You're looking out. The self is not there. And that's involved. That's truth. Now you're really seeing what is true. You have intelligence. You are involved in reality. That's the whole purpose of the book, is when can the how can a person be happiest? When he's involved in reality. And that is when he is mostly involved in a life of pursuing wisdom. If a person is just the opposite, and he's pursuing a life where he's just projecting himself and wants everything he does during the day to be some sort of expression of himself and to get the accolades of others and to feel a self-image, so then what's always haunting him is the fact that he can never move that far up. He's limited inherently. And that's the parable between light and darkness. Light means you actually see what's there. It's the truth. Light shows you what is real, what is there. That is reality. And then you'll have your happiness because you're not fighting reality. And why is it that we're happy when we don't fight reality? Because that's how God designed us. All right? It's like taking a round peg and sticking it in a square hole. You can't. That is going against the reality. But if you put a square peg in a square hole, it will fit perfectly. It's made to do an act of fitting, and it does because it has the right shape. The same thing, if we fit in with the way we are designed, with our shape, and our shape means all the emotions that we have, and also the other half of us, the intellectual side, if we're satisfying all areas, then there's no conflict, there's no frustration, and we have a sense of serenity and enjoyment, and that's really what the person should be looking for. He shouldn't try to assume that, oh, if I build this, I build that, that's where happiness comes from. If I build myself up, that's where happiness comes from. And you have to study the human condition before you can make any assessments as to where happiness comes from. Doctors just don't freely prescribe medication. They see what the ailments are. They see what medicinal sources exist. They trial and error. They find out what results come about. And through many years, they finally arrive at something that can work. Okay, any questions or comments? Let me pause here.
Rabbi?
Yes, Cal?
I find myself thinking Yahoo is really featuring that new tower in Dubai, and that they don't even want to tell exactly how tall it is because they're afraid somebody else is going to want to build one bigger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it. Funny thing, why a high building is a cause for celebration.
Well, you think of the risk, too. They were talking about how dangerous it was for the construction workers and the risks that are involved in something like that. It just seems crazy.
Oh, well, that's our society, our world is bent on. They have this very interesting website you should take a look at. It's called TED, like a person like Teddy Roosevelt. TED, TED.com, and their motto is basically ideas worth spreading. And there are very innovative minds there with technology, or art, or psychology. And I was looking at a few of the presentations. And these presentations may be about 20 minutes each, from the last couple of years. And one of them was this woman who heads up the Cassini spacecraft that's now all the way out in the reaches of Saturn, and had even dropped a probe onto one of the moons, of Saturn, because there was some interest about the haze, the cloud cover, and they discovered great amounts, and then they never were able to see through the haze from outer space with this probe that actually landed on the surface and sent back images from the actual surface. It was the first time they ever saw. And she was going on, and the audience was applauding, and it is a great, you know, it's an amazing thing. But there was one name that was omitted from the entire 20 minutes of the oohing and aahing. You know whose name that was?
No.
God.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning they were completely enamored with their abilities to get these objects out there and the far reaches, and it's the furthest satellite that man has ever made that had, you know, that the furthest it has ever reached. And you know, they're observing all this, but they forget, you know, who created it all. And they're amazed by what? By the existence of the thing. That they can get there? Is it a combination? It's an interesting phenomenon. But it never came back in her conversation about the creator, as if these things can create themselves. So it's showing you a certain mindset. And yeah, and all they're doing is finding out facts. Yes, there's methane rivers, and they have cloud cover, and they have rain, and they have all the same phenomena on Earth, but since it's 350 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, all this is taking place with methane instead of water. All right, where do you go from there? What does that do for you? And the other thing is also, you know, they found another moon that's like completely ice, another Saturnian moon that's completely ice, and they noticed as the satellite was orbiting it that there were plumes of ice being sprayed out 30, 40, 100, 1,000 miles into the atmosphere of that moon. Like all these numerous jet streams shooting out. So they said there could be some source of life, because they also saw that there was discoloration in certain areas that has to mean that there's some biological reason for it. And now the idea of there being life other than Earth, wow, amazing. But think about this. Let's take it further. See, again, that's the same thing as what Gehalis is trying to show people. People stop at a certain point. They have an assumption, and they don't explore that assumption. Oh, if I can just have that, you know, that car, if I can just build up this empire, if I can just make that new building in Dubai, whatever, that's going to be wow. But they don't stop and think, well, how is it going to be? And will it really give me that assumed feeling? So these people that are looking for extraterrestrial life, so let's say they do find it. All right, now what? So now they found that there is life, but isn't that life going to have a certain limit of its design, just like human beings? And if that's so, wouldn't it be more amazing to be in contact with the source of that extraterrestrial life? And isn't that source of that extraterrestrial life the same source as everything else in the universe, the Creator? Well, guess what? We have something called the Torah that gives us that communication. The fantasy and the projected emotions on these type of things, it stops at a certain point, and that causes some of the, if not all, of the errors and the assumptions that people have towards us. And if we follow the path that King Solomon sets down, then nothing is left unexplored. And if we get into that habit, we will start saving ourselves from a lot of the frustration that we're met with because we don't think things through, or because we have assumptions as to, well, will this really, you know, this plan that I have now, and this desire, or this underlying emotion that I'm assuming is really going to provide me with some happiness or success, is it true? How is it going to work? Let me think it through. So that's what King Solomon's primary lesson is here. Take it to the end. Think it through. And don't just stop and assume that your assumption is correct, even though everybody else might be doing it, even though it sounds very pleasing to certain emotions. Think it through. Will it really provide what you think you're looking for? Is it really addressing you as a complete human being, or is it only addressing one part of you and ignoring another part, which will just lead to frustration? Look at other people. Has anybody else tried what you're assuming you're about to try? what type of success have they met with? Were they in a vicious cycle their whole life? Were they ever happy? Did they ever spend one penny? Or did all these billionaires die with every penny they earned? Like this guy Warren Buffett. Billions and billions of dollars, and the guy still drives around in a jalopy and a house that's like nothing to look at. So what type of philosophy is this guy teaching you? And is he taking anything with him more than a person who's making only $60,000 a year? What more is it after he's gone? You see, the King Solomon says in the next verse, in 14, he says, the wise man, and it sounds like he's repeating what he said in 13, because in 13 he says, I have looked, and there is a benefit to wisdom from accomplishment, as there is a benefit to light over darkness. And then what does he say in 14? The wise man, his eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And I know, yes, I know, that one event will happen to everybody, meaning death. Now he talks about as if he's putting down wisdom, which is what we'll do next week. But you'll see now it's a continuation about wisdom, but now it seems like he's bringing up a new point. He just praised wisdom, but now it looks like he's putting it down. Yes, it's true that a wise man, his eyes are in his head, and the fool walks in darkness. But I know that one event happens to both of us. And I said, in 15, he goes on and he continues, and I said in my heart, as the event happens to the fool, it will also happen to me, meaning death. Therefore, why have I become wise anymore? And I said in my heart that this is foolishness. So you've got 14 and 15 is what we're going to take up as the next critique and the next insight. And it sounds like it's contradicting what he already said in 13. But it can't be. He can't be contradicting himself. All right. Any final questions? Any comments?
I think we're good here.
All right. So we will continue next week with 14 and 15. That's where we'll start off from. And if you have any questions,
thank you so much, Rabbi.
Sure. If you have any questions or comments during the week, as usual, feel free to email. And if not, we'll pick up next week at the same time.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks so much, Rabbi.
Okay, everybody. Have a great week, everybody.
Well, you have a great week,
too. Bye, buddy.
Okay. Bye-bye. Good week.
Thank you.